Episode 41, April the 9th, 2011. Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. ATUK is a not-for-profit amateur astronomy podcast produced by me, Gurbir Singh, an amateur astronomer based in the UK. For more information, see the About and FAQ pages at www.astrotalkuk.org. Yuri Gagarin and Reg Ternil. This is another episode to mark the 50th anniversary of Gagarin's spaceflight, and a link to the video of this interview is available on astrotalkuk.org. Reg Ternil joined the BBC in 1956 with the remit to cover aviation and defence. The launch of Sputnik 1 in the following year expanded this remit to include space. He is particularly well known for his coverage of the American Apollo program. In the UK, his name and face, along with that of Patrick Moore and James Burke, is associated with commentators who covered live the Apollo moon landings on the BBC. In April 1961, Reg was sent to Moscow for Gagarin's first post-flight international news conference. It turned out to be a fascinating story of Cold War politics as well as leading-edge space technology. In his own words, Reg describes this as a phony press conference, an entirely choreographed event designed to humiliate the West, and summarised the whole press conference as good-humoured evasion. Interacting through an interpreter and restricted to submitted written questions, he had to put aside his usual analytical approach. Besides, he recognised that this was a great achievement. This interview was recorded on January the 19th, 2011, at his home on the south coast of England. Reg, where were you when you heard about Gagarin's flight into space?
I was in London. In fact, I was doing some interviews because the Americans were planning to close down some of their bases in Britain. Oh. And I was doing stories about that.
And, of course, you went off to Moscow for the very first space conference 2 days after the flight itself. What are your recollections of the Moscow press conference?
Well, it was the most phony press conference I've ever attended. And although I put the best gloss on it possible at the time, it was a really unpleasant experience because they gave me a visa in London quickly enough to go to Moscow. And you must remember the Cold War was at its height, the really unpleasant atmosphere between the West and the Soviet Union. We called them the Soviets those days, not the Russians. And when I got there, I had to queue up half the night trying to get a ticket to get into the press conference. And when I arrived there, it was the Academy of Sciences Hall in Moscow. My ticket was waved aside as if it was not important, and it didn't. They said, no, it not, doesn't count, and so on. And with a number of other foreign journalists, I was kept outside, and we could sort of see into the hall through the door, which was barred to us. The front of the hall was filled up with all sorts of space officials and Soviet civil servants and so on, the front half, and the big half, the upper half, while we were still kept outside, was filled up with crocodiles of nurses and, quote, workers being marched in to take all the seats. They were quite deliberately torturing us, and I was quite worried. The BBC having sent me there and paid for me, I began to think I was not going to get my story, you see. It was most unpleasant. Of course, they made bookings for me to broadcast and so on. Finally, when the conference was just about to begin, they let us in. There were quite a small group of us at the back there of foreign space correspondents. I can't remember who they were now. So I was quite unable to link up with a VisNews cameraman who was supposed to meet me. I never found him. And I went in, and the hall was packed, and I looked around desperately for a seat, and halfway along a row at the back of the conference hall, there was one seat amid all these very large, heavily built nurses, so-called nurses. I forced my way into the seat through their knees and sat there. Then I had to get up again, and they said written questions only, so I had to write my questions, force my way out, go down to the front and drop the questions in a box, and then force my way back again with all these tittering nurses. It was really most unpleasant.
So the idea of having the nurses and other people, was this a bit like a rental mob to fill up the space?
It's exactly what it was. It was a phony press conference from beginning to end.
And it was, in a way, the Soviets trying to assert their superiority in their success.
It was an entirely choreographed occasion, really, to humiliate the West and humiliate people like me as representatives of the West.
Were there any American reporters there?
Well, there must have been. But as you see, we were all mixed up. What happened to the other people who went in? I mean, when we did go in, we were a small mob pushing our way in. Everybody was sort of panic-stricken because they didn't know where to sit or what to do or anything. And I was on my own, very much on my own, when I found this seat.
And there were press from all over the world, not just Europe and America?
Well, presumably there were, yes. But I was not aware of them, you see. I was aware of them when we were in a group outside. But once we were in the hall, everybody was spread out trying to find an odd seat. And there were no proper seats for the press at all as you go.
You say that questions and answer session was pretty much superficial. Have you got a few examples?
Oh, yes, indeed I have. It was all terribly worrying because we had an hour and a half of speeches in Russian by all the various officials, which were partly translated. There was a man named Boris Belitsky, whom I got to know in later years quite well, an excellent translator, but he didn't really translate much of the opening speeches, so we didn't really know what was going on, except there were great preambles about the workers and so on, and all these formulas they have for introducing it. And I sat there for an hour and a half getting more and more fidgety and worried because I thought I was going to miss my broadcasting slot, you see. Yeah. I had to go to Moscow Radio where I was booked in to do a broadcast for radio and television news. So finally we got to the questions and there was this bright young man, very impressive. I was always very impressed with Yuri Gagarin, a very smart young man. In fact, he was picked, of course, because although they'd selected over 20 cosmonauts and trained, he was obviously the brightest, most self-assured, and yet he wasn't vain or arrogant. He was a rare human being. He stood up and started to answer our questions. And then, of course, we got what journalists call the classic idiot treatment. Perhaps I can give you one or two examples. You see, when I asked him about did he land inside the spacecraft or did he eject from it on the way down? This was very important to know. The Western scientists wanted to know because it gave us a clue to how sophisticated the spacecraft was. The first question to him, which was used, was, did you land inside the Vostok spacecraft or eject and descend on a parachute, you see? As I said, this we desperately wanted to know the answer. It was a very important answer for the Soviets, because they wanted to claim this as an aeronautical, international aeronautical record. And to claim this as a record, the pilot had to be in the spacecraft for launch and landing. Mm-hmm. So that was a secondary reason we wanted to know. Uh-huh. And the answer he gave to us, he was pulled down by Academician Blagonrogov, who was sitting in the chair, and he whispered in his ear before he answered. Uh-huh. And then Yuri stood up straight and smiled and looked at the audience, and the answer that we got was, whichever way it was, you can see it was successful. There was a roar of laughter, and this set the tone for the whole conference. I can give you some more examples. When were you told you were the first cosmonaut? I was told in good time. How many cosmonauts are there? I believe there are more than enough to undertake important flights. When will the next space flight take place? I think our scientists and cosmonauts will undertake the next flight when it's necessary. And then, and so it went on, the whole way. Everybody roaring in laughter. And when I describe it was an example of good-humoured evasion. Well, it was good-humoured as far as the audience was concerned. They were all communists who thought it was all terribly clever. Mm-hmm. And then my question, when I can go and watch an American space launch whenever I want to. When will I be allowed to watch a Soviet launch at Baikonur? And there was a long answer to that in Russian. And the nurses all around me were bouncing in their seats and jeering and bumping up against me, both sides. And I hardly heard. When the translation came, there was so much laughter and jeering, right. It was hard to tell, but the gist of the answer was that they certainly weren't going to let the Western spies in to see and copy their very advanced launch rockets. And that epitomised the whole conference.
Did you feel you got anything worthwhile from the conference in the end?
Well, I didn't get much information, but of course I got my story. I managed to get a taxi, I managed to get to Moscow Radio, and I did my broadcast. So that was moderately successful. And later on, I was able, of course, having had some first-hand experience of Gagarin, it was very useful to me, because only a few weeks later I was in America for Alan Shepard, the first American space lob, and I was able to do a broadcast comparing these two young men. And I was astonished how similar they were in abilities and type. They were both very intelligent young men, able to stand up in public and give a good account of themselves.
In your book, The Moon Landings, an Eyewitness Account, which is full of incredible detail, you spoke to somebody who speculated that perhaps Gagarin didn't go on the flight at the time and date that they said, because they did actually announce that he was in orbit whilst he was in orbit, which is very unusual for the Russians at that time, the Soviets. they always wanted to do the mission and then tell people about it. Are you now comfortable that the events of Gagarin's flight were on the schedule?
Yes. At the time, we were exceedingly suspicious that it might have taken place a day or two earlier and then been made to appear as if it was new, just they played the recordings and mm-hmm. so on. In fact, it turned out that our suspicion of that was as crazy as the modern fallacies about the Apollo program having been
conspiracy
faked.
Theories.
It was not faked, but it was a long time before we get the details of it. In fact, it was incredibly meticulously prepared in an almost schoolboy way. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the Soviet media, like TASS and Novosti, mm-hmm. had been given sealed envelopes in advance and were told which one to open according to them, whether the mission was a success or a partial success or a failure. They got all these sealed envelopes mm-hmm. and were telephoned during the mission, during the flight, and told which envelope to open and which to use. And Gagarin himself had a sealed envelope. Uh-huh. We learnt all this later. Mm. He was not allowed to operate the spacecraft at all mm-hmm. Because they were worried that the weightless environment might incapacitate him. Mm-hmm. And he was only given the sealed envelope with the code to operate the computer if things went wrong and ground control lost the ability to control the spacecraft. In fact, they never did, and we learned subsequently, but not for 10 years, that in fact he was automatically ejected from Vostok at 7,000 metres. He was ejected sitting in his seat, mm-hmm. and once ejected, the seat fell away from him, and he came down on a parachute, very successfully. But for 10 years, Gagarin went around the world giving the impression, and even lying on some occasions, that he'd remained inside Vostok for the landing.
Oh yes, it's something he frequently repeated throughout his trip to the UK, certainly.
Yes, so he tried not to lie. Soviet scientists, we always discovered, we always knew, they hated lying, right. And usually they did not lie, and this was a great help to correspondents like myself, estimating what they were going to do, because when Moscow Radio reported the missions, I was able to listen very carefully and see what had been left out of the announcement. And I could tell a great deal from what was left out, more than from what was put in.
I haven't come across any specific evidence which shows perhaps radio reception from Vostok 1 whilst it was in orbit, independent of what the Soviets told us after, and indeed during the orbit itself. Are you aware of any independent radio transmissions and receptions outside the Soviet Union from Gagarin's?
Yes, the American intelligence picked the flight up. There again, couldn't discover for a long time, it was classified. They picked up the transmissions within a few hours, about 3 hours, I think, they picked it up, and they knew there really was a man in space, but this was classified, and we were not told just how much the American intelligence had been able to monitor.
The Soviets were, of course, surrounded by an atmosphere of secrecy. Again, something else you mention in your book, that besides the overt secrecy of the Soviets, the Americans claimed openness from the start, but in your book you say, looking back with knowledge of what went on, I have modified my views considerably. Can you illustrate what you mean by the sort of secrets that the Americans
Well, when NASA was created, just before Gagarin went up into orbit, only a few months before, with instructions that it was to be an open, they were to be very open, they were to answer all our questions, in contrast to the behaviour of the, in this case, the US Air Force and the US Navy, who were both fighting one another to get control of manned spaceflight, human spaceflight, I must call it now. even today, books are pouring out. At this moment, I'm reviewing yet another book about Apollo. After all these years, 50 years, I'm still discovering things I didn't know in these books. Little things are leaking out.
Today's quote is from Reg Turnell's book, The Moon Landings, An Eyewitness Account. Following John Glenn's second spaceflight in October 1998, Reg, at 83, the oldest working space correspondent, asked John Glenn, the oldest spaceman, a question. In part, Glenn answered, "Old folk have ambitions and dreams too, like everybody else. So why don't they work for them? Don't sit on the couch, go for it."